and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the poet Mickey Myers. Mickey Myers is the author of two books of poetry, Trigger Finger and It's Probably Nothing, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love My Implants, a breast cancer memoir. She is a graduate of CMU in Pitt and has been writing and teaching in Pittsburgh for over 20 years. Her favorite topics are epic failure and utter disaster. Hi, Mickey. Welcome to Prosody.
Hi.
We're happy to have you.
Thanks very much. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah. Can you start us off by reading some poems?
Absolutely. I thought I'd read a few from that book. And I'm going to start with the title poem. It's called It's Probably Nothing. No, actually, it's everything. I know you mean to be reassuring, but the only thing nothing refers to right now is what else is on my mind. I have some more about a bout of breast cancer that I had. So this whole book is about what it's like to go through breast cancer, the ups and downs of treatment. And one of the downs is sometimes the things you don't realize. So the music in the lobby of the hospital, for example. So this poem is called Muzak. The hospital atrium's automatic piano is treating us to a spirited rendition of the Elton John catalog at double speed and out of key. There's nothing like a wobbly I'm still standing to give the impression that tests aren't going to come back good. That's N. McGee. Everyone knows their player piano. It's a little bit of a downer sometimes. Another thing that I noticed when I was undergoing treatment is that you like to live dangerously. So this one is called Disabled Driver. I'm pretty sure that the DMV would prefer that drivers have full range of motion in their arms when operating a moving vehicle. How else am I going to get to my physical therapy appointment if I don't drive? Every week, they measure incremental gains, a centimeter here, a bit more grip there. By the end of the first month, I can even use my right arm to help steer by leaning my shoulder into the wheel. I'd love to be able to park in one of the disabled spots, but as a recent amputee, with half the use of my left arm and none of my right one, I am not disabled enough to score a windshield sticker. The book goes from the various stages in treatment for cancer. So it starts with diagnosis, goes through surgery and chemo, and then finally getting better. And I like to look at the side of treatment that isn't usually depicted in books or the things that doctors don't usually tell you. So this poem is called 20 Gauge, and many of the titles in the book are puns. This is one of those titles. So 20 gauge refers to a number of different things here. 20 gauge. Not the shotgun, the IV needle. That's what the nurses claim they use to shoot the chemo up with, but it isn't. They use 12 gauge on me. I know this because I kept one of them. The difference between being shot with a 12 gauge instead of a 20 gauge is akin to a scratch and getting your face blown off. Sometimes it takes 6 or 7 tries for the nurse to hit the vein right, working her way up your arm so the drugs don't leak out of the holes she's left behind. When your arm's all used up, they use your palm instead. They don't tell you this in the helpful cancer books. If needles make you queasy, don't get cancer. Opt for something else. I saw a woman pass out once, dropping like a dead deer on the floor, thump, just like that. And she wasn't even the one they were aiming at. She was just there with a friend for support. The final one I'm going to read from the book is called Mixed Metaphor. I like writing poems that take two different subjects and weave them together. So here, obviously, I'm talking about writing, but I'm also talking about being ill at the same time. So Mixed Metaphor. Every dinner time, you pop that little white pill and hope it knows it's supposed to prevent you getting more cancer rather than give you more cancer. Tamoxifen is, ironically, a known carcinogen. they discovered that the radiation routinely prescribed to keep the cancer at bay ends up causing heart disease down the road. If it's not one thing, it's another. You roll your dice and hope they come up heads. Then you realize dice don't have heads. They don't even have tails. All they have is numbers, and they're just odds. People tell you it all evens out in the end. You hope you come up trumps.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Mickey Myers. So there's so many interesting things that are going on in that book that I'd love to talk about. The first few poems you read were short.
Yes,
were rather
they are.
Short. So how do you come to terms with writing a short poem? What constitutes that length for you when you're drafting or revising?
With these particular poems, I was going for the anecdote. I was going for the quick view. I didn't want poems that were so long that they tripped over the subject. I wanted to get in and out quickly. It's a book about one whole subject, and mm-hmm. I feel that it was really easy to be able to dip in and out of it if you're reading a little bit at a time. For some people reading this kind of material, it can be emotional. Often breast cancer survivors are reading it, and sometimes they just want to get in and out quickly, too. Mm-hmm. I think it's harder to write a short poem than
yes.
it is to write a long poem, too.
Definitely, because you have to pick and choose so carefully
yes.
what is left in and what is left out. So that's why I was fascinated by the length. But I like this idea of getting in and out quick. I think that's also a metaphor for the whole experience, probably.
Hopefully,
a little
yes.
bit, too. And this idea of working with one subject matter throughout a whole book, how is that? Because I find that very challenging.
I love reading books that are about one thing. Mm-hmm. I think the challenge of making a book about one thing, no matter how long the book is, makes it like a little movie. You have to think about a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you have to take that one topic on that journey with you. So like I said, this particular book deals with the four different stages of cancer. We know that cancer diagnoses are staged in terms of the severity of the disease, and I wanted to mimic that in the book, but make it hopeful. So stage four isn't death, stage four is recovery, and the whole book is positive. So I wanted to carry that note through the book.
Mm-hmm. Is it easier to write those poems as you're living it or when there's some distance?
That's a very good question, actually. I'm often asked that about this particular book. I actually wrote most of these poems long after the events because I didn't want to be somebody who was writing about my cancer journey while I was going through it. Actually, I was too exhausted when I was going through it and too mm-hmm. scared. But afterwards, I sat down and I kept thinking of little things that I wanted to remember or wanted to comment upon. And so I started writing about it once I had recovered. And I found that I wasn't as sentimental about what I was going through, mm-hmm. coming at it from a distance, which really helped because the book is humorous.
Right. That's
you don't
another
often
thing.
Find humorous books about cancer, but it's humor about the absurdity of what you go through, not mm-hmm. laughing at cancer itself.
Right.
And doing it from a distance helped with that. Mm-hmm. I actually had cancer again 7 years later, a completely unrelated, separate case. And coming at it again the second time, I found I was really helped by having written about it the first time. So the second time, I wrote about it while I was going through it. Mm-hmm. But because I'd had the first time experience, it was a little bit different.
So you went back and read your book?
I didn't read the book again. I just thought, okay, if I could continue what I had written in the book, mm-hmm. how would I carry that voice mm-hmm. through this second experience?
And I'm glad you said that there's humor in the book because that's what I noticed a lot about the tone was it's sort of whimsical almost and playful. And what a great juxtaposition that is with the subject matter. Was that a conscious choice or did that happen and you were like, oh?
I think it was a bit of both. I consciously wanted to be funny and I found that I couldn't write about the topic unless I was being humorous mm-hmm. or looking at the dark side of the humor. I wanted to make a book that you couldn't find anywhere else. When I was diagnosed with cancer and I went to the library and got everything off the shelf, mm-hmm. all I could find were clinical books or very uplifting books that didn't feel like they related to me or the questions that I had. I certainly couldn't find anything that was funny. And I thought, as I was going through the experience, that sometimes you laugh at your condition. You laugh at this ridiculous thing that happened to you, and that laughter is the best medicine. I know it's a cliche, but if you can laugh at what's happening to you in the worst of circumstances, it helps you get better.
Mm-hmm. That is so true. And also, you talked a little bit about the mixed metaphors that you're working with. What draws you to that as a way to enter a poem or write about a subject matter?
I love words. I love the history of words. I love the different kinds of meanings that one word can carry. So I find that in my writing, I'm often thinking about what one word means and how it means several different things. And that's something I draw on in poetry, because poetry is such a spare, every word counts medium. If I can find a way to make those words count twice, then right. I've got something there.
So on this, back to this idea of one subject matter throughout a text, are there particular books of poetry that you can call to mind that do that, that you admire?
There's a number of chapbooks that I think have done that very
well. Chapbooks are a good container for that type of.
Absolutely. They're a nice length. And there's a chapbook company out of Albuquerque called Zerk's Press, run by Mark Weber. And he often does chapbooks that are just single topic ones, or one single story that's being told through several different poems in the chapbook. I love that. Yeah. I like poems that deal with a similar topic. All the way through.
Can you read us some more poems?
Absolutely. I thought I'd read some of the poems that I wrote the second time around that continued the type of thing that was in my book. Again, I was playing with humor. So this one is called Opportunity Cost. One of the hidden costs of cancer isn't the toll it takes on your health, your relationships, your family, or your career. It's literally on your pocketbook. At $5 a pop, the parking alone is killing me. Now, this one is called Progress/Regress. And in the book, my son is a toddler. And the second time I had cancer, he was much older. So this is about that. My son turns 10 today. And every time his birthday comes around, I think about having made him, my body building a perfect other person who will soon be taller than me. Meanwhile, I am beginning to look like something that was made by a child, composed as I now am of bouncy balls, lumps, patches, stitches, and glue. I love the way that surgery came a long way since my first surgery, and now they seal your wounds with glue. Who would have thought? This one's called Being Cured, and it's one of those poems that has a double twist on the word that we mentioned. Being Cured. If you want to preserve a piece of meat, you cure it. You pack it in salt to draw all the moisture out, or leave it to dry in the wind or bathe it in smoke until it takes on a different quality, tougher, preserved, full of flavor and a wicked sense of humor. If you want to cure a person of cancer, you do the same thing. This one is somewhat playful. When I was undergoing chemo, you're in a horrible position. You're not at your best. And this is something that happened to me when I was not at my best. And it's called Autograph. If you have ever wondered what it must be like to be asked for your autograph, it's pretty sweet. The first time I was asked for mine, I was having my chemo switched over. Lying back in a recliner, wearing a stocking cap and hoodie over pajamas, under two warming blankets and a fleece throw, half asleep from Benadryl. I was very flattered and took my time to sit up and try to string two intelligible words together to thank her for buying my book without slurring too much, and concentrated really, really hard on making my hand write actual words, and then had a mild panic attack when I momentarily forgot how to spell my own name. A true story. Like, great, but right now, really? This is one that's not quite as funny, but it has a certain poignancy and ring of truth to it. It's just called Meeting. Telling people you have cancer comes about as easily as being told you have cancer in the first place. Spreading the news is akin to introducing yourself at a meeting of the afflicted. Hi, my name is X, and I have cancer. Except that no one replies in unison and with empathy. I've had cancer for 9 years and a few months and 3 days, and sometimes I fall off the wagon. For a while, I was cancer-free. There is no coffee, there are no cookies, and no one really wants to hear your story, despite the look on their face. It's a communicable disease. When you tell people you have cancer, they get dis-ease. This one is another play on words, but really about the play on the way the words sound. And it's called guarantee. Assurance and insurance aren't the same thing. To ensure that I won't have to worry about the certainty of cancer returning, all I have to do is be sure to cross my fingers and hope for the best. There is no warranty on this flesh machine, no matter how much worrying you do. The only guarantee is that there are no guarantees.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host, and my guest today is the poet Mickey Myers. So I'm curious, I'm still very drawn to this humorous and playful tone and direction in these poems. Did you get opposition for when you were crafting poems about cancer that you wanted to be sort of funny or humorous? Did you have in your workshop group or with your editors say, I'm not so sure about that?
I actually didn't have any workshop group. This was really me just writing for myself at first. I just wanted to record these experiences. I had it together as a little kind of manuscript. I wasn't really thinking about sending it out and making it public because at the time it was still for me a very personal story. I didn't necessarily want to be that person who was telling everybody about this very intimate thing that had happened. Then the manuscript kind of accidentally fell into the lap of my editor and ended up being published. And one of the things I think that appealed was the fact that it was unusual, the fact that it was humorous. The readings that I've done and the groups that I've met with since then have been many times cancer groups and cancer survivors. And it's very rewarding to have a huge group of people laughing their heads off about the horrible thing they're going through. So I've had a lot of very positive feedback about the humor. There was only one time when I heard anything else, and that was on a podcast I did, and somebody had called in and accused me of making fun of people with cancer and how cruel I was being. And I said, no, you got the wrong idea. I'm not making fun of people with cancer at all. So that's really been the only time I've heard something negative about the humor. And I'm hoping that people can understand that I'm not making fun of cancer.
Right, definitely.
I'm making fun of a situation.
Right, it's the situation. I just find that, did you write any poems that had a tone that was sort of sentimental or sad, or and those just didn't make the cut, or did you just totally try to avoid that direction?
I didn't have any poems that were sad, but I suppose I did have some that ended up being somewhat sentimental or poignant. I have some poems in the book that balance out the humor or the slapstick in there that are about my children, say, and how they were reacting to having a mom who was undergoing cancer. So I think one of the powers of humor is that if you marry it with something that's not funny, it makes the humor even more funny. So I tried to do that in places where I would drop in a poem that was not quite as
Right. And it's sort of the tone of the speaker in the poems, too. It comes at the reader is very direct, and this is happening, and this is what's odd about it, and funny, and look at it that way in the moment. That's hard to do.
I didn't want to shy away from what really happens, the nitty-gritty of what happens when you're undergoing this experience.
Right. And but to look at it through the lens of, okay, this is a little bit odd and kind of funny, and because not everybody would see it that way.
That's true. And actually, since then, there have been a number of books that have come out that have taken a similar tone.
Oh, you're a trendsetter.
Yeah, I don't know if it was me, but I think that publishing maybe has has changed a little, and that people are more willing to see graphic novels
right.
about this kind of topic, or mm-hmm. people writing humorous things about dark mm-hmm. subjects.
Right, especially something that you see all the way through, you know.
So many right. people are affected by this.
Mm-hmm. Can you read us some more poems?
I have a couple here that are about disasters. In yes. the beginning we said that's my favorite topic, and I think it ended up being one that I love. I love when things go horribly wrong for some reason. So these are a couple from a project about history, where I look at various well-known figures in history in moments that we don't usually see them. So I have one here about Marie Antoinette. We're all familiar with Marie Antoinette. Here, I'm pointing out something people might not know so much, which is that she actually had a huge gambling problem. So I'm focusing on that. And these poems are anachronistic. So they take place in the historical period, but with modern touches. So here we have Marie Antoinette buys fake Laboutins on eBay, Versailles, 1775. The Queen of France places yet another bid, but not for once, on which card she'll be dealt next. Sure, she could always pay whatever they charge at the boutique, but she likes playing this game, offering up just enough to win whatever catches her fancy, a killer pair of heels, a shepherd's crook, a couple of matching gilt lamps from the Petit Trianon. They're up to their necks in debt, but isn't everyone? She's willing to bet her life that they're the real thing, but when the box arrives from China, she knows she's been duped, and sure enough, the shoes smell like formaldehyde, the soles too dark a shade of red. Still, she slips them on under her desk, a reminder that if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. Sometimes she wishes she hadn't been born one of 16 children to be married off for politics, the odds of producing an heir one big gamble for Europe. When she runs out of cards to play and they come to collect at last, she clicks her heels 3 times, closes her eyes, and whispers, "There's no place like home. There's no place like home. There's no place." And we all know what happens next. This one's about a slightly more modern guy, Evel Knievel. I love Evel Knievel. He was a big hero when I was growing up. He spent a huge part of his career, after he was jumping around on motorcycles, being somebody people would go to get autographs from. And one of the props that they had, in addition to all of his motorbikes, was like a medical skeleton. And they would have little bits of red tape around all the places where he'd broken bones, because that, at the end of his career, was what he was known for. He's this guy who's broken nearly all of his bones. So this poem features that medical model. And this is true. All of these details here are true. Evel Knievel slips in jacuzzi, breaks rib. July 1998. Not sure whether this one counts. His agent would like to add it to the skeleton hanging in the demonstration trailer, already bearing 9 lives worth of red tape to mark each break. Can't believe his luck, really, to have a client so prone to sacrificing himself in the name of self-promotion. In January, they replaced a hip to match the one he broke playing golf, and every time he sees it, he feels a twang, hoping no kid asks which crash it came from. He's an old man now, an apparition hobbling about the fairgrounds and speedways, signing autographs with gnarled arthritic hands, hawking Harleys and leather jackets to the sons of his original fans. Every now and then, he drifts off before his agent taps him on the arm. "Snap, snap," he says, grinning money as Evel flinches. "Snap, snap, snap."
So what do you read or Google to find out all these interesting facts about famous people?
I Google Wikipedia, like everybody else.
And stuff like that turns up, gambling problems and
all kinds of things. I also have a huge collection of weird books, so mm-hmm. I like to go to those for inspiration.
That's great. Can you take us out with a few more poems?
This is a poem from my first book, Trigger Finger. And it's got a title called Untitled, because I think that no poem should be called Untitled, so I was making fun of it. If the camera steals your soul every time it shoots you, then this isn't really me. There I am. There I am again. At the concert, do I look at the stage or giant screen? I report myself to myself in appliance store monitors like feedback. It's not natural to know what you look like from behind. Too much information. I've been Xeroxed until there's nothing left but fuzzy shapes, a Rorschach blob of copy ink. There are duplicates of myself all over town, caught inside endless security cameras, touching fruit and selecting underwear. Sometimes I'm on the evening news, walking past the reporter. Someone snaps the guy I'm next to, and I end up a stranger in another family portrait. Anonymity erases everything. Aren't we all just walking reprints, stills cut from the reel, bullets and headlines, flyers floating in the breeze? There's no copyright on me. Go ahead and shoot. I'm free. This one is called Smile from the Camera. This book was very much about pictures. The title, Trigger Finger, wasn't just about guns and things that you pull with a trigger, but about the flash on a camera or a shutter. So this is called Smile for the Camera. Here is another shot of the sky. A few hairs that may or may not have been mine. He almost got it right, almost held steady long enough to hit something that would knock us flat, preserved in Polaroid forever. Here is yet another shot of the family, a slant of grass with the lower half of someone else's battered jeans. Here's half a face that might have been my mother's, the fingers of a hand that might have belonged to me. He can't say for sure, the 60s and 70s ripped from the reel into the light of 1,000 snapped out synapses. Here is yet another shot of the sky, another good intention, a foot cartwheeling through the frame. That was inspired by all the awful Polaroid pictures that were taken when you were kids, when you only had one chance to take a picture, mm-hmm. unlike today, mm-hmm. and you ended up with nothing in the frame. Here's a poem about something that was, again, a little bit poignant. This is after a photograph. I love to look at photographs and get inspiration from them and tell a story that perhaps hasn't been told. This one is from the Civil War photographer, Matthew Brady, who photographed Civil War troops, and he often moved them to make a better-looking scene. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't exactly journalistically sound. This is called Sunken Road, Antietam Creek. Two Union men stand above a ditch filled with human debris. A shoulder in the foreground, a leg, a boot, no trees. The dead are in such sharp focus, it's as if their souls need a moment to identify themselves and grieve. The living have no heads, but blurs where heads should be. One is trying to remember the punchline to a joke he heard 3 days ago because it's the joke you always tell at times like these. The other's murmuring a prayer that could be a reminder. Breathe, breathe, breathe.
The poetry of Mickey Myers. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for asking me.
It was great. You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.